This is CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com, 4 minutes after seven, and a Thursday morning, which means the burning platform. It's some of our favorite time of the week where we get to talk about all the things that are going on in the world and we try to make sense of those crazy things. And chief among them this week are issues like the NHI, which our regular returning champion, Canthan Pillay, has just written an article on. He'll tell us about that in a second. But as usual, it's brought to you by Nando's. Nando's is smart enough to know that they can get involved in controversial conversations. And they can have some fun with it too, which is precisely what we try to do. Pumi Mashiko, Canthan Pillay, good morning. Are you ready to rumble?
Oh, flipping awesome, guys.
This is not celebrity deathmatch.
Well, are you ready to rumble is the best way to start
the Betty White fan club.
Yes. So, let's begin.
Welcome, Canthan, new members. Canthan Pillay.
Canthan wrote an interesting article which was published this week. Which publication's this in, by the way?
It's a secret publication.
Oh, it's a secret one.
It's only for members of my tribe.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, well, you sent it to us, so would you share it with the rest of
well, you guys
people?
Are part
we
of my
in
tribe.
The tribe.
Yeah,
we're exactly. In the tribe. We're in.
So share it with us. Proposed NHI, an unmitigated disaster waiting to happen, is what you've called it. So, all right, we've discussed a little bit of this morning. We had a really interesting email from Dr. Robin, who's a regular contributor to the show. She's a gynecologist obstetrician, and she has her own private practice. She has no idea of how the NHI is going to impact her. None of us do. The only ones who do seem to be Zweli Mkhize, who's got an idea that this is the bestest, nicest, coolest, most awesome, shiny thing he could ever come up with, even though he didn't.
He didn't.
It was already postulated by the former minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, but it comes from the ANC. This is their think tank, whatever's left of that, whatever broken, leaking, creaking thing that is, came up with this idea. And Canthan, where does it actually come from?
Look, let's just start off with the trial that was run for the NHI. There's a trial that's been running for the past 5 years.
Where is this?
At a number of locations around the country.
Okay.
So there were a range of separate locations where the trial was run,
yeah,
and a cost of 4 billion rand was put into this. And the trial basically failed to achieve its primary objective, which was to have better health for people who were in the trial than people who were not in the trial. So, for example, kids that were identified to get particular medication did not receive the medication that they were meant to receive. Doctors who were purportedly trained to be part of the trial had no idea how to actually go through the process of actually implementing it. So when I talk about an unmitigated disaster, it really is an unmitigated disaster.
You're not being dramatic.
I'm not being dramatic. No. And Pumi, you were asking earlier on about people who take the trouble to read through the bill. I actually read through the bill in its entirety before I sat down and wrote my piece. And I came up with reasonable extrapolations around what would happen if this thing were suddenly put into practice today. And the conclusion that I came to is that if the NHI had been in place at any time over the past 20 years, when I've had two cases where I was close to death,
right,
and then I had a daughter who was born 10 weeks premature, and in all three of those cases, we would be dead, literally, just simply because the facilities that currently exist, thanks to the private healthcare system and medical aid, which were able to save my life and save my daughter's life, would just simply not be available to us. And that's what makes it such a disaster.
All right, so this trial, because I don't know anything about this, the first I've heard of it is what you've just told me now. It's cost all this money, 4 billion rand.
Yes.
And they've failed.
Well, 4 billion is actually chicken shit compared to what the additional cost is going to be. There's an additional 256 billion rand a year at minimum that needs to be found in order to pay for this. And the way in which they're going to pay for it is they're going to remove our private medical aid. The money that all of us previously used to pay for medical aid, they're going to take and put into a fund. But we're not going to get medical aid for that.
But we're paying for that. We don't we get to decide where our money goes? Is
no.
this what they're saying?
No, we don't.
The government will choose that for you.
Yes.
Someone who hasn't made their money will decide what will happen to that money.
That's exactly right.
And you won't have a choice about your healthcare practitioner or the medication you receive or the clinic you go to or the hospital you end up in.
No.
No choice.
No choice.
Now, where does this come from?
Well, it comes from Karl Marx, you know, two centuries ago. As you know, this is stuff we've discussed before. You know, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And the whole idea is that intelligent people, and let's be very clear, you have to be an intelligent person to become a doctor. Mm-hmm. But intelligent people are meant to be the intellectual slaves of the masses, of the stupid masses, I must point out.
How is this something which they expect? I mean, I thought it was just a money grab.
It is a money grab fundamentally because, you know, all of this money has to be channeled through the NHI Institute, which, you know, so very shortly they're going to be appointing a chief executive plus a board, you know, who will be drawing salaries for the next, up until the period of implementation, which is supposed to be 2026 before it comes to pass. But let's just talk about the mechanics of how they're doing this, because obviously right now we've got very competent medical aid schemes in this country, and yes, you know,
some of the best industries, and in fact, they're world leaders. They absolutely, in some respects, like Discovery, for example.
Yes, they absolutely world leaders. Others, and, you know, well, Discovery gets a disproportionate amount of
Because they're huge
Of publicity, because they're huge. Yes, but the others are extremely competent as well, and and they cater to, you know, very specific niches. But essentially, in the very first chapter of this NHI bill, there is a proviso that says the Competitions Act of 1998 shall not apply to anything listed under the NHI, which means that they have the ability to arbitrarily shut down all competition in healthcare and create a monopoly in the form of government.
How's this possible?
Well, it clearly
you would have to enclose the country in an envelope, not let anything that isn't approved in, and not let anything that isn't approved out. It goes against free market principles, choice, liberty, freedom.
Well, the constitutional implications just in terms of that alone is a complete mindfuck. I have no idea. I mean,
surely, just on that basis, it will fail at the starting gates.
Well, on the assumption that the judiciary doesn't do something stupid. Now, there was a case some years ago where, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a public healthcare patient in Durban who was getting dialysis on a regular basis from public healthcare.
Right.
And he was not in a position to afford to go to private healthcare. And the state health in Durban said that he was, that he couldn't keep getting free dialysis.
Right.
And he took the case all the way to the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court said that they could not force the state to keep him alive. So the state turned off his dialysis and he died. So
there are moral and ethical dilemmas here.
Absolutely. Right. And but essentially, and don't but, get but, me by don't
virtue,
get me wrong.
Hold on. By virtue of that case you've just cited now,
yes,
it would appear that government's interest is not in doing the moral right.
Absolutely. Government's interest is not necessarily in doing the moral right, but that doesn't mean that we should necessarily rely on the Constitutional Court to be our savior, given that there is this damning precedent that says that ultimately they will not dictate to the state how private health care should actually
public health care.
Yeah, so, sorry, public health care should actually take place. So, yes. So that's the situation that we find ourselves in right now. The price fixing, I think it was Robin, the person who wrote it.
Yeah, she's a doctor.
Yeah, she's a doctor. Yeah, she's absolutely right. They are price fixing. They are saying, we are going to set the price of what you are willing to charge in exactly the same way as the apartheid government set the price of bread. What happened when they did that? There was a bread shortage.
Yeah.
You know, people who don't draw this correlation, you know, actually don't understand.
So, all right.
Please, because in your article you also talk about the alternative, you know, the voucher system. Please, will you explain that system to our listeners?
Yeah, please.
Well,
to me, first of all, so, I mean, like, I don't even understand.
Look, there were lots of, you know, at the time that we were coming up with the broad, you know, alternatives. So, you know, one of the reasons why we started that whole ZACP was to come up with alternatives that actually work, and to look at international best practice and see how.
And you were mostly a bunch of pragmatists.
Yes, right. Completely. And if you take a look at what Israel currently does, Israel has universal health care.
Yes.
And Israel's universal healthcare system is one of the best in the world. So everyone gets access to free universal healthcare. If you're paying tax, obviously it's you're paying for it ultimately. But if you're unemployed, you still get access to to universal healthcare.
Okay.
But the idea is that there are four private companies.
Yes.
They're not-for-profit companies, in exactly the same way, by the way, as Discovery Health is not-for-profit.
Right.
Because I must point out that, you know, the Discovery organization as a whole is for-profit, but the medical scheme itself is basically they are managing contributions on behalf of the members.
Everybody
and allocating it. And that's the way medical schemes actually work. So in Israel, there are four separate companies, each of whom provides services across the board. And the idea is that you as an individual, you sign up with one of those particular companies who is then obliged to provide you with a minimum level of care, which is all of the things that, so it's things like reproductive health, it's things like chronic care. You can't be kept out because of pre-existing conditions, you know. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if something like asthma, for example, or if you have HIV, they can't deny you access to the healthcare program because of those pre-existing conditions. And guess what? It actually works. Israel is listed, I think it's number, but anyway, they're consistently in the top 10 of the world in terms of the quality of healthcare for, and all of the African countries, by the way, are in the bottom 20, just so you know.
All right, so what does this leave us with?
Well, what it leaves us with is there has to be, I'm going to use Pumi's favorite word, a myriad of constitutional challenges to take place.
Right.
And it's going to be a drawn-out process. And
Do you see this ultimately being implemented? Do you see the government falling, as they always do, before they get to the finish line?
Well, the government tends to dig its heels in on irrational policies, no matter how disastrous they are.
So the plan then is to make lawyers rich.
Well, the plan ultimately is to make government rich. Well, it's going to be people who are part of this food chain.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, immediately there's going to be a chief executive officer appointed for this. I wouldn't be surprised if it's Olive Shisana. She's been one of the people who's been campaigning quite vociferously for this thing to.
What are her bona fides, by the way? Do we have? I don't know much about Olive Shisana.
Oh, Google's Olive Shisana. No.
So no bona fides. I'll take your word for it.
Yeah.
Jesus.
So, but that's going to be the starting point in terms of this. But look, the immediate impact of this, since Thursday, 15 billion rand wiped off the collective value of the healthcare companies in this country in terms of stock. Money has fled immediately. Again, in terms of money fleeting, by the way, I was running through numbers yesterday. The amount of money that is currently leaving the bond market on a daily basis is 2 billion rand.
A daily basis?
On a daily basis, 2 billion rand of foreign money is fleeing the country from the bond market. And, you know, so for every single person out there who backed Cyril Ramaphosa to put him into office, and I'm sending a shout out to every single person who dipped into their pockets to give 400 million rand so that this man could buy votes and get into office. And
thanks to a leak last week, you know exactly who these people are.
We know exactly who these people are. And you've created this unmitigated disaster that's descending upon us. Doctors are fleeing the country. And, you know, I feel for Robin. I know that there's... I know of other doctors in exactly the same situation. They're committed South Africans. They really work their asses off on a daily basis to do the best that they can while everything's crumbling around them. But others have fled. Yeah, I've got family members who are doctors who are no longer here. They migrated.
All right, so we're between a rock and a hard place. Who is their model for this NHI? Is it the British National Health Service? Is it Cuban? Who do they mold and model this on? Is there any existing system?
Well, nobody
system?
Seems to have asked Ramaphosa that question. And
Where would they find him to ask him that question?
Nobody
talking to the Women's League yesterday.
Yes, but no one even asked him the question of whether he's currently using the public healthcare facilities. You see, the pattern, of course, for governments throughout Africa is that they never have to rely on their state healthcare facilities. They fly off to Singapore or they fly off to Russia in the case of Jacob Zuma.
Yeah, and they never do go to these. I mean, they're not. He said yesterday he was warning about how infighting is going to chase investors away. You heard about this. It's like someone who's really. Some things are dawning on them suddenly. You'd think for someone who had a functional system around them that they could have been informed about this a little bit sooner. And it's not infighting, Cyril. It is your complete mismanagement of the economy.
It is indeed. And all right. You know, mismanagement would require that he actually play an active role in some way in running this country. I have not seen him doing anything that actually contributes to the decision-making process. No. Other than to stand up and say, whether you like it or not, NHI is here to stay. And thank you, 15 billion rand wiped out in an
instant.
Done.
That's clearly worked out beautifully for us. So far, your decisions have done nothing but cost us money.
And of course, the fascinating thing is that, you know, all of these investment companies are now turning around and saying, look, you know, there's opportunities here to be had. You know, you can buy these stocks at low prices. Actually, no. This is not a good time at all to be buying stocks in the medical companies because it is going to get worse.
Can we just talk about, and let's be charitable for a minute.
Why?
Because I'm curious. I mean, if you can't hear a good argument against your position, you're not paying attention. So let's imagine for a minute that there are some things in this bill which are laudable, and there might be.
The objectives are laudable. The objective is to provide decent universal health care. And
utopia.
And, yes, and you know, those objectives are objectives that I share. I'm just saying that the way in which you achieve it,
you can't get there with this.
And I've given one very practical alternative, which is to say, take the money that we currently have in the national health budget. Currently, because if you break that down among the 50 million people who currently don't have medical aid, because people who have medical aid are currently using private health care in any case. So for those who don't have medical aid, which is 50 million people, you take the national health budget, translated per person, that works out to 376 rand per person per month. Now, the entry level package for most medical aids is between 500 for children and 800 for adults per month.
Entry level.
Mm-hmm. But the entry level package is actually fantastic. I mean, so, you know, if you're on Discovery's entry level package, for example, and I'm not endorsing Discovery by any means, but their entry level package will provide you access to their network of physicians, unlimited GP visits, that is, gives you access to their network of hospitals, and your hospitalization care, in most cases, your treatment is pretty much unlimited. So immediately, and of course, chronic medication is factored in and all of those things. Now tell me that there isn't an incentive for these health companies to create a package that's designed at 376 rand per month, especially if they're going to have 50 million new contributors shared among these among all of these healthcare companies in some way or the other. And absolutely, they would be able to do a significantly better job than government is currently doing. At very least, they'd be able to ensure that you have access to your medication on time, because they have partnerships with the likes of Clicks and Dischem so that you can go there and pick up your own. And by the way, that's the other thing. You won't have any choice in terms of the type of contraceptive that you want to have, because government will decide what type of contraception you want to have. Mm. Let's say you want to have a birth by cesarean section, which in the private healthcare system, most births that occur in this country are elective cesarean sections. Mm-hmm. Government will say no. They will decide whether or not you want to have a cesarean section.
Hmm.
People don't understand the extent to which this is messing with our ability.
And you're
to make
talking
choices.
You're talking about mostly health decisions as opposed to decisions of life and death, which often will come into this as well. For many people, this is a situation of no option at a moment where you don't have a choice.
Correct.
Really. And I don't mean don't have a choice as in terms of medication or doctor or procedure. Like, they will decide, sorry, we're switching off your machines. Effectively giving the state the ability to terminate lives.
Yes. That's pretty much what they are doing. But
this is a very, very serious thing. I mean, I'm trying to find the funny part of this. Is there any argument to be made for the state being a good custodian of us in terms of morals and ethics and best practice and all that kind of thing?
Well, I'm looking for a single example that we can use where the state actually works. And there's only one thing that the state has ever gotten right in this country, and that's SARS. It's the ability to steal our money on a monthly basis.
Ta-da. I think we can wrap up the burning platform there. It's 24/7. Do you want to hear about Cardi B and Bernie Sanders? Because he's a guy who's big. He's massively in favor of a national health insurance. In fact, he's been punting this for the longest time in America. He says, I want the single-payer option. This is what he says. So he's been doing the rounds, and I've got to credit Bernie with this because he's going to unconventional places to spread his message. Whether or not he is the Democratic candidate, it's highly unlikely he'll be able to out Joe Biden as the front runner. But let's imagine for a minute that he did. He's done some interesting groundwork. He was on Joe Rogan. He's going in Cardi B. And although he's a crazy old socialist, he really is. You know, he had
a millionaire socialist.
Yeah, which is always the hypocrisy of it. I mean, that's the same as the elite in Moscow during the Soviet era. They're all fine, but everybody else suffers for them. I mean,
That sounds familiar.
It's very familiar, especially if you're in the ANC's oligarchy. So let's look at this for a second. Here's Bernie with Cardi B. All right, he's on Cardi B's show. Take a listen.
We're called the 10
nail.
Do I know nail bars? Hey. This is Senator Bernie Sanders. I am with Cardi B. We're at the 10 Nail Bar in Detroit, Michigan, talking about some of the most important issues that impact you.
Education, jobs, wages, police brutality.
Now, we're in the nail bar. Cardi's nails and mine are just a little bit different, but we hope you'll tune in.
Yes.
All right, so you can tune in to hear Bernie Sanders talking to Cardi B today.
I'd rather watch paint dry.
Yeah, I you don't think either of these people have a massive contribution to make? I mean, Cardi's not particularly. A good working class girl. She's made it big. She was a stripper. She's become a worldwide celebrity who's making amazing music.
Let's just talk about healthcare in the U.S. right now.
Yes.
Obamacare was a good thing, and it still is a good thing.
It's been dismantled, hasn't it?
No. Well, what has been dismantled is they've removed the ability to force people to buy health insurance. But your ability to buy health insurance is still in place. And more importantly, the ability to not get excluded because of pre-existing conditions is still in place. You see, the thing that Obama did that was, you know, kind of clever, he said, look, essentially, if you have a choice that either you go and buy a healthcare program, if you're working, that is.
Mm-hmm.
You either go and buy a healthcare program.
Yes.
Or we're going to take that money away from you in the form of tax. So your choice was, you know, either you're going to spend it in a way that's going to improve your health, or we're going to take it away from you. So he wasn't actually forcing you to sign up for healthcare, but he was saying that if you don't sign up for healthcare, we're going to tax you.
So
and the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. They said, well, absolutely, he has the right to impose federal taxes. So, yeah.
Yeah, so essentially, your idea of a voucher is a little bit like what Obama did. So instead of giving people vouchers to say, go and buy healthcare, he's saying, I'm going to give you this tax break. If you don't spend it on health, I'm going to take it away from you. You
Correct.
Have to spend it on health.
Yes.
Now, that seems reasonable.
It is reasonable. And look, the only reason why... Okay, there's a couple of reasons.
Because at the moment... Look, let's just look at it this way. We have two kinds of healthcare in this country. There are people who have nothing and people who rely entirely on the state, which is what they want to make everybody do. And then there are people who slave and work all day and all night just so that they can pay their medical aid because it is expensive. But it is the only way that you can get care that doesn't get dictated by government and have to go to state hospitals and get superbugs and all kinds of other things. So you have to pay a lot. We pay a premium in this country for that kind of thing.
Correct. But it is a life and death situation. And
of course,
you know, again, using myself as an example, you know, I would have been dead. My daughter would have been dead.
So is there any argument? Because I always think that at the heart of the ANC's manifesto and its NDR and everything else is this idea of equality and egalitarianism.
Yes, we'll all be dead together.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only possible outcome in a utopian scenario. But are rich people in this country that far from poor people that we're almost indistinct from each other? I mean, that we are completely living in different worlds. And what will happen? Is there a way that we will still have this two-tier system, even if the NHI comes in?
Well, remember, we're not talking about rich people. Let's be very clear about this. I think you might have seen that I tweeted yesterday that there's currently discussion. Well, it's wage talks and wage talks going on between NUMSA and MIBCO, which is the Motor Industries Bargaining Council. This is with regard to
increases.
With regard to increases. So they're asking for two things. The one is that they are asking for an increase in their salaries, but they're also asking for the employer to pick up 60% of medical aid costs. Now, understand that we're essentially talking about a unionized workforce out here. Medical aid is of critical importance to working people. It's not something that is the preserve of the rich. I mean, obviously, those of us who are on the very expensive healthcare programs pay disproportionately. But for people who are earning less than $8,500 a month, which is the cutoff point for the medical aids before they crank up your fees, because currently you do actually pay increased medical aid depending on how much you actually earn.
And bear in mind that NUM is part of the Tripartite Alliance.
So they've
This is NUMSA.
NUMSA.
Yeah, NUMSA. Oh. Yeah.
Okay. Mm.
Yes.
Okay,
which is Urban Gym's former thing, right? Isn't it?
But either way, the unions seem to have a backdoor to government all the time anyway, whether they're members of COSATU or not.
Well, a question is whether the unionized workforce is going to actually accept the replacement bus service in the form of national health. I don't think so. But
even they might be against this.
Well, I'm fairly convinced that they will be against it. But at the same time, the number of people in the unions has declined significantly. And Cyril has already warned that more of them are going to lose their jobs. So they're not really a force to be reckoned with.
Mm. All right. Well, let's look at one other thing that I thought maybe you could explain to me. This inverse bond yield. Do you know how to explain this? Because people are asking me about it and I have no idea of how to make sense of it. Basically, the government bonds, in other words, an investment you make in the government of the United States. They have 10-year ones and they have 2-year ones. The 10-year ones are now yielding a negative amount. So if you invest money for 10 years, you'll actually get less of your money back than
if you put it in for a short term. Yes.
Right, and the price of those bonds is at the highest they've ever been.
Yes, and which historically is a sign that economies are about to go into a recession.
So if this happens, and I don't doubt that part of what has exacerbated this situation is this trade war of Donald Trump's against China.
No.
You don't think so?
No.
But what is this a result of?
Look, the question of whether a recession actually comes about, I think that there are a number of signs that this might potentially be happening. You've already seen signs that in Japan, for example, they're heading towards deflation, you know, which is when the cost of things actually starts dropping.
Wow. And it must be nice.
Yes, it is nice. But, you know, from the point of view of actually growing an economy,
it's not good. And obviously good for people who are investing money, they don't get a return on those investments.
Now, the other thing that's happening is that there has been an overall increase in terms of prosperity, particularly across the Western world. I popped up the UK's latest employment stats yesterday. The UK Office of Statistics released that, and it showed that employment in the UK is now at the highest level since 1971. Employment among women is at the highest rate ever in the history of the UK. I think it's something like 72%.
Although they still have a 25% unemployment rate because their employment is 76 point something.
Pumi is missing a critical part of the equation out here, which is the fact that there are people who are actually retired.
But your employment rate is about people who should be in employment.
Stop playing identity politics while we are talking about the economy.
It's not identity politics.
Yes, you are.
If you are talking about employment, you are talking about people who, the universe of employable people.
Oh, goodness. All right. I'll send you the links to what you need to read up on later. But your primary understanding is flawed in this particular case, much as I love you.
All right. But
what is their employment rate?
Let's just go back to what we are talking about here. We are talking about the inverted yield curve and how it's generally...
Yeah, we'll get back to the UK employment in a second. I've got questions there too.
But basically, the whole idea is that historically, whenever you've had an inverted yield curve, which is what we are seeing right now, that's generally been a precursor to a recession.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right. So that's the only important thing I needed to hear there. And maybe that explains to a lot of people why there's so much flutter and noise and panic in the markets as a result of this inverted bond yield.
Yes. But remember that from Trump's point of view, that generally what happens is that when there's panic in the markets, where does the money go to?
Gold.
Yeah, it goes to the U.S.
Does it?
Yeah.
U.S. dollar.
Yeah. No, well, the U.S. is generally considered to be the safe haven, and it flees out there. So, which is why I'm saying that you can't actually... You can blame it on the trade war to some extent, but
he's backpedaling on the trade war. He just made an announcement yesterday to say that...
He's not going to do anything until Christmas.
He's going to hold back on the next set of tariffs until the 15th of December. To give Americans a break. Now, he realizes that what he's doing with these tariffs is he's imposing an extra tax on his own people.
Yes and no.
For what purpose?
Because interestingly, if you take a look at all of the goods to which tariffs have been applied, there has not been a knock-on increase in the pricing of those commodities in the U.S. So in other words... The whole idea that you're going to end up paying more for it has gone away. Now, the people who have actually been suffering are the likes of soybean farmers in the U.S. But what Trump has been doing is he's been taking profits that he's been getting from the tariffs,
mm-hmm.
and he's been giving handouts to the farmers in the form of subsidies.
Right.
So, you know...
It's protectionism.
It is protectionism, but you know, to a large extent. I mean, do you ever stop to consider why it is that you know tomatoes that we import from Italy are often priced cheaper per tin than locally produced tomatoes? It's because Europe does exactly the same thing.
Protectionism of their farmers. All right. To go back to Pumi's point, though, when we look at employment, is it, especially when we look at employment of women, do we consider stay-at-home mothers and carers and that kind of thing
as employed?
In the informal sector. Do we consider them employed?
No.
But yes. Can we talk about the definition of what an employment rate is about? Sure. The employment rate is about people in the population of employable age. So it's disingenuous to say people are retired. The employment rate definition.
That's why I'm asking.
Is employable people. So if you say your employable people, 74% of your employable people are in employment, it means 25%, 24.6 or whatever
I'm
of them are not.
To the point, it's not for me necessarily about retired people. I'm not sure if that is the case. And Canton, you may have found more information than we did in this respect. But certainly on the face of it, it would appear to me that if there are disparities between male and female in employment, it could have something to do with stay-at-home mothers.
You see, the crucial thing for me is that...
Is that not a more valid answer potentially?
No, you see, the crucial thing for me is to say, does the US, the UK Office of Statistics use the same measures that everyone else in the world does? And they do. So however you want to slice it, okay, let's not pick on the UK right now for saying, oh, there are so many people who are unemployed. Let's just say that comparatively with what they were in 1971, they are at the highest rates ever.
Yeah.
And that ultimately is what we are looking at. Across the world, we all benchmark ourselves at the same level. Now, if you want to drill down into say, oh, yes, but life is still terrible for certain parts of the populace, yes, absolutely. No one is saying that. What we are saying is that if you measure improvement overall, they are at the highest levels of employment for women ever in the history of the country.
Which is laudable.
Yes. And
should be celebrated.
And really, that's what we should be focusing on. We shouldn't be doing any of this. Really, if we nationalized the entire thing and just gave everyone a job, we would be better off. Pumi, Stop with the communism.
I don't believe that you have to nationalize the entire thing.
You're nitpicking on the basis of gender.
You know, I always find it so fascinating, the words that we use for, and it's not nitpicking around the gender. The gender equation of it, I'm indifferent to it. And I mean, it is true. There are more women are employed in the UK today in executive positions than for a ever before, simply because more men are also choosing to be stay-at-home dads. So that gender equation is not what I'm particularly interested in. I'm particularly interested at the fact that when we speak about employment and unemployment, certain it's where you choose to put your view. If you say employment rate is X versus if you talk about the unemployment rate is X, that's all I'm talking about.
All right.
Calm down, guys. Manufactured outrage.
You win.
Dear Canton, you live in a dream world. This is according to Carla. It says, you live in a dream world. Do you think that the government will voluntarily give up those billions and the chunk they need out of it?
No, of course not. Yeah. Okay.
And then he includes anarchy as a state of disorder due to absence or non-recognition of authority or other controlling systems.
We already have anarchy in most of the rural areas of the country.
Yeah, we do.
The state completely lacks the ability to enforce the ability to pay electricity bills in Soweto.
Which we have an email.
I saw the email.
Tebucho's email.
Tebucho's email,
right, so
yes.
Let's go to Tebucho's email. Poor Pumi's taking a bit of a hammering this morning on the burning platform.
You know.
Betty White rules.
Tebucho says, dear Gareth, do not be misled by Pumi Mashiho, please. It's calling you out by name. Soweto people haven't been paying Eskom for years, as most are using the normal billing system instead of the prepaid system. By my granny's house.
Most are using. Oh, okay. Not all. Okay.
Okay, but we've never said all. Nobody.
That's
nobody,
my point. Carry on reading Tebucho's email.
At my granny's house, we owe 98,000 rand and we started to pay Eskom back 4 years ago at about 1,500 rand every month. But we use up around 900 rand, so 600 goes to debt. My whole street owes Eskom thousands of rands. In average, 200,000 rand. None of the houses have been paying because most don't have the money. But each and every household has DSTV dishes outside their houses, and most are renting out their back rooms for 1,200 rand each room. Pakistanis with a shop, which they pay 4,000 rand a month. Eskom has tried to negotiate with people to install prepaid electricity, and they will scrap half their debt, and they started blocking roads and striking. So now because people in each household are overloading the transformers literally burnt, and now 80 houses up my road are without power since the 13th of June. Eskom told them that they won't use their money to fix it for people who don't pay. They tried striking and burning tires, but nothing has happened. I'm happy that Eskom is standing its ground this time. P.S. It's time the people in Soweto start paying, and Pumi doesn't know what she's talking about. Tebucho.
Okay, so shall we break it down?
Right of reply
what
to Pumi.
I am against is
singling out of Soweto.
No. What I am against is the generalization of individuals, right? We don't like people to be lumped together. All men are trash. Don't like that, right?
I agree, yes.
And by his own admission here, Tebucho says, right, mm-hmm. that some people are on the prepaid system. But also, on his own admission, they are paying, his family. He starts out at people are not paying. And yet here he is paying each month for his electricity usage, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not saying that there are people who don't pay or who do pay. I am simply saying to generalize is wrong. And why is it wrong? Because we don't like it applied in any other way to us. Is Tebucho paying? Yes, Tebucho is paying. Is he paying too little? Yes, he is paying too little. And yeah, we spoke about this last week. Cut them off. Cut them off. If there are people who are not paying, cut them off. But to generalize and say people in Soweto is bullshit. And to say, I mean, the whole reason to say people have got satellite dishes outside of their houses doesn't mean they are paying for their subscription. That is the whole reason why MultiChoice actually included a pay-as-you-go system, because people were not paying their subscription prices. Mm-hmm. Manufactured outrage, guys. Manufactured outrage. Simply because we are not listening to each other and what people are saying. The words we use are important. There's a reason why we have two ears and one mouth. Listen.
All right. Very good. You want to add anything?
Ganthan spoke about historical debt. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about historical debt. He's only paying 600 rands towards his historical debt.
Yeah. Well, it's his granny's. So he has to foot the bill for his granny who probably doesn't have a job. Right? So, I mean, look, these are very practical and real problems for ordinary people. But the fact is that we do have a, and this is something that Helen brought up the other day, and I thought it's worked on me. She said, accountability is responsibility with consequences. And in order to be accountable, we need to understand that there will be consequences if we are not responsible for those duties. And too often in this country, we don't see any accountability, whether it's from our leaders, whether it's from big business, whether it's from ordinary people on the street. I mean, you brought it up with e-tolls a while ago, and Pumin and I scoffed at you because we don't like the idea of e-tolls. But effectively, what we're doing is nothing short of civil disobedience and a lack of accountability, right?
And that ultimately,
which is the South African way of being.
That's it. That's what I think we've got to acknowledge.
Ultimately, ends up screwing us. And I was driving back from KZN at the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you doing anything dangerous there, Canton?
Well, you know, being a South African is an inherently dangerous occupation, especially in KZN. But no, you know, my Zulu people look after me. Yeah, you know, I
King Goodwill, who probably won't like what you intimated the other day.
Oh, guys, speaking of Zulu people, are we not going to talk about Makumet?
Yes, I think
and her veiled threads.
Yeah, but let me just wrap up this point that I was making because
you drove back from KZN.
Yeah, and getting to the De Hoek Plaza, it took us a half hour to get through the toll gate.
Sure.
Okay, because of the sheer backlog of vehicles. And look, if there were e-tolls there, we would have all cruised through, and there wouldn't have been any of the backlog.
Yeah.
And the fact is that.
You don't go through the Shesha lane with the tag, no.
I'm saying that in order to get up to the gate, you had a half hour backlog.
Jeez.
Just in order to be able to get up to the point where you could then duck into that lane. It'd be a different thing if there was a separate road, you know. But
yes, all right, let's talk about.
Okay, yes,
we have to talk about Makumete, please.
All right, this woman is finally, and I did give credit to the ANC, even though I'm not sure it was the right kind of credit. For firing her. They fired her. This never happens. We almost never hear about people in public office being fired. The ANC in
well,
in
I think the technical term is recalled, and they did recall Jacob Zuma. So yes, it happens.
It happens rarely.
Yes.
But I think when they do it, it's a good thing in the ANC because they don't often, usually people are put in indefinite suspensions.
But she also has to resign from her position as mayor.
So what?
The legislature.
What was her veiled threat?
Her veiled threat is, you know, she's going to be a disciplined cadre, and like we've heard it before from another prominent Zulu politician, that when the time is right, she will talk.
Hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean she has secrets?
So she's a disciplined member. She is going to take the PEC's recalling, right? She's going to. You
which,
know?
By the way, the Women's League didn't like, Batabile and Company.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, Bata. But when the time is right, she'll talk.
I wonder whether the ANC hasn't got so many dirty secrets that it's actually, all of these things are meaningless. Like, there's no scandal that I could be told about the ANC now that would be too bad for me to bear. Like, I would expect only the worst from them. So I don't think any of this Smolanyana skeleton stuff really has much sway anymore.
No, we have the level
if you've
of
got stories. Let me tell you something. If you're in the ANC right now and you have stories, you may as well just tell them. Because either you'll be assassinated before you get to tell them, or people won't even care when you do tell them. So you may as well get them out.
Well, can I offer a more cynical viewpoint in terms of what's going on in Durban?
Please.
Consider that they now have the person who's meant to be running the municipality and therefore being in a position to push money in the direction of cadres, who is not in her office based on the fact that she's facing criminal charges. So that means that there's no one there to actually sign off on money that needs to flow into the coffers of the party. So given that the situation with the criminal proceedings is not going to be resolved in the short term. In order for them to keep the money flowing, they need to put someone new into office. Hmm. So that's my cynical viewpoint.
So it's just about the money.
It's
again.
Just about the money, yes.
You know, for a bunch of people who say that they're not capitalists, the ANC are inordinately consumed by material wealth.
Uh-huh.
They really are. This is the deep irony and hypocrisy of the ANC, is with their National Democratic Revolution, it's merely a means of ferreting the money away into their own private property pockets and has nothing to do with what is good for the citizenry.
I'm quite certain that between Sihle Zakalala and Willis Mkhunu, they have a name.
I'm pretty sure, absolutely, yes.
For sure.
To put out there.
Willis Mkhunu is the guy who passed out when he was at the podium not so long ago for the State of the Province opening, remember? And he said, I am having a challenge.
He's the deputy chairperson.
You sure
of
he
the
wasn't
province.
Poisoned as well, Pumi?
Hey, guys, how is he doing, our friend out there? Is he still in hospital?
I don't
the
know.
Because yes. no one is talking about
it. You asked that question last week, and nobody is actually.
No one's talking about it. The men, you know?
So Ash makes an interesting point. He says, I have a friend who keeps saying, if Cyril wasn't good enough for Mandela and he had to choose Mbeki, then he's not good enough for me.
Wow.
Well, the fact is, Cyril was outmaneuvered by Thabo Mbeki. Thabo Mbeki is a much more wily politician.
Shem Cyril. There's a very famous Nigerian author.
Imagine you had to wait 20 years to be important enough, for everything to be desolate enough that you looked like a leader.
Yeah, he squandered it. I mean, I think a lot of people, what a lot of people miss with the revelations of all the people who gave money to his campaign is how much goodwill Cyril had.
Yeah,
a lot of people backed him. A lot of people were backing him. A lot of people gave, you know, they put their money where their mouth is. They were like, this guy is going to be, you know, he's going to be good for the country and the party. This is the guy. They put their money behind him. And he's absolutely squandered it. And there's a very famous Nigerian book, which is very apt for Cyril's new dawn, called Sunset at Dawn, The book is a comedy, but it's also about, it's set in the Biafran War, but it's about what happened in Nigeria, kind of. And when we look at what's happening here, the trajectory.
Well, we'll talk in a moment about this IMF. We're running out of time, but I did see Mogoeng had some interesting things to say about how we've got to deal with corruption and reposition ourselves if we wish to succeed and not be a failed state. So he's also speaking in quite dramatic terms now. He's the Chief Justice, the head of the third branch of government.
Dipping his toes into that political branch of government, isn't he?
Damn right.
Yeah, well, I think as long as he speaks in broad brushstrokes, I have no problem with that, because he's not really saying anything different to what many people have been saying for the longest possible time.
Now, R.W. Johnson wrote an interesting article that's doing the rounds at the moment about how what is inevitable is that all roads lead to the IMF.
Hmm.
There is no one else who can pay Eskom's debt. There is no other lender of last resort but the IMF. But of course the ANC don't like the West. So they've looked everywhere else they could. They've tried the BRICS Bank. They've tried all kinds of things. There's no one else who will pay for this mess that they have made. And what this means if they don't go to the IMF is that government workers will not be paid. I mean, we had a situation with Danel not so long ago when they almost couldn't pay their people.
Well, have they been paid since?
I'm not sure whether that has happened. If
look,
they
the,
have,
the situation in terms of the IMF, you know, just drills down to one very basic thing,
yes,
which is whether we get a further downgrade. Because remember, right now we've already got capital flight out of the country. As I said, $2 billion a day is leaving the bond market, and the bond market is the way in which government borrows money from the rest of the world. And right now we're still attracting people to our bond market based on the fact that we are offering very high interest rates. And, you know, I mean, if you consider that right now, the US's interest rate is about to head into negative territory.
Which means you'll get nothing for your investment.
Exactly.
Get less than nothing.
You get less than nothing.
You still get, what, 6-7% or so?
Well, ultimately, you have to consider the fact that because it's rand denominated, as long as the rand maintains a position against the US dollar, then you'll be getting roughly that 6%.
So the IMF only come into play if there is a downgrade, because
Well, at the point at which there's a downgrade, the money that's money is already leaving the bond market mm-hmm. because they've already sensed the threat.
Mm-hmm.
But people, you know, there are people who are risk takers who are still there, and they say, well, yeah, but 6% is still better than I'd currently be getting from, let's say, Brazil. So let me just keep it here for a while.
Right.
And but at the point at which we get a further downgrade in terms of our investment rating, that's the point at which most, if not all, of that money is then going to flee the country.
Right.
Which means that we can't borrow money on the open market based on the fact that we are considered to be high risk. It's exactly the same way as if you happen to be an unemployed individual and you go to the bank and you ask them for money to buy a car, and they're going to assess your finances and they'll say, sorry, we're not going to give you money. That's exactly what the ratings agencies right. do with us as a country. And we're going to end up with a situation where, because we're not able to borrow money on the open market, but we still need to borrow money in order to keep the country running,
mm-hmm.
that's when we go to the International Monetary Fund. And the International Monetary Fund will say, sure, we'll let you have money in exchange for your doing the following things. And it means that you scale back on the largesse that you're currently distributing to public workers. You have to cut jobs and all of that type of thing. And at that level, I think it's a good thing.
All right. So ultimately, it's not the bleakest possible outcome. I mean, there are worse things. There's the complete failure and collapse.
Yes, I'm saying bring it. I really would prefer it.
You'd like the IMF to run the country rather than the ANC.
Yeah, look. Currently, you know, we're on a downward spiral anyway, and the sooner the IMF comes in, the sooner all of these idiotic ideas like the national health insurance will actually get shut down.
Right.
Because there is no way that the IMF will agree to fund something like that.
What do you say, Pums?
But let's not forget that there's still our pension funds to steal from.
Yes. And the, IPC, what is the thing called that they're busy, Dan Machila's busy explaining himself away with?
No, PIC.
Yes. I'm not getting the acronyms right this morning. NHI, PIC, ANC, IMF. It sounds like the kind of word soup. Yeah, the kind of word soup that children learn when they're trying to make fun of each other. Do you want to add anything on the IMF?
You know what? I'm sorry to say, but what we are seeing is South Africa is the last one in line of African states failing. Our leaders have failed us. Our African leaders have all failed us, and South Africa is in that line where they have failed to see what has gone before. You know, there's a Zulu saying that says, "Indlela ibuzwa kwabaphambili." You know, to know the way, you have to ask those who have walked it. And we've seen what happens. We've seen what happens with large-scale looting across the continent. And here we are, this, you know, our hope in the, you know, our hope in the ANC and our hope in the new dawn has been completely squandered, which means, you know, people, we got to do it for ourselves.
Just a quick question, by the way. Does anyone know where Jacob Zuma is? Because no. I understand that...
apparently they tried to deliver some notices to him via the sheriff.
Yes, well, Hanukom is...
Derek Hanukom is suing him.
Is suing him and so was trying to
and,
serve.
And yeah. they, so this poor lawyer from Weber Wenzel went to Forest Town. Nobody was there. She went to Nkandla. Well, the sheriff went to Nkandla to deliver this. Nobody was there. They went to all the different business addresses for which he is a director. Nobody could take delivery. His lawyers said they will take delivery, but they haven't heard from their client. So it would seem that he has gone to ground.
He's on the Twitter streets. Have you not seen him tweeting?
Well, they even delivered via Twitter as a direct message, and there was acknowledgement that it had been read.
He's on the Twitter
blue ticks, apparently.
Is that legal?
I don't know.
Okay.
But if anyone sees him, please, will you help Weber Wenzel to find him so they can deliver this important information to him, and he could be sued by Derek Arnold.
He might be wearing a blonde wig.
On his official account, I mean, he tweeted, when did Peter Mbeki's article come out on Sunday? On Sunday evening, from his official account, he tweeted another Zulu saying, "Yapopulinkezo," meaning, shit is hitting the fan.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Really? You think shit's hitting the fan for him, or is he talking about the country?
It was just like, generally.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Anarchy.
This has been fun. Yes, we'll end with that definition of anarchy that was supplied to us by Carla. Thank you very much. So look it up, and we will talk again next Thursday. Same thing, same time, same place. Much more exciting and interesting stuff, I'm sure, because the new week will bring new and exciting stories. You can be part of the Burning Platform, even if you only caught a half of it, by listening to the entire show by going and downloading it from cliffcentral.com. Big ups to Nando's for always being unafraid and unashamed and willing to be part of the important conversations too. Pumi, Canton, thank you very much. We will see you tomorrow.
This is CliffCentral.com.